This episode features discussion of kidnapping and violence that some people may find offensive. Listener discretion is advised, especially for children under 13. Michael tensed when he saw the cannon-mounted flatbed truck on the road in front of him, but his fixer told him to relax. He pointed to the slogan written across the truck, called a technical, used during the Somali Civil War. But this technical, the fixer explained, was on their side. Michael breathed a sigh of relief.
A car behind them honked and the technical pulled out, forcing them to stop, its cannon pointing at the windshield. But Michael stayed relaxed. This technical was one of theirs. These men were friends.
He tried to stay calm, even as the men jumped off the truck with their AK-47s pointed towards the car. Mike told himself it was a traffic stop. They just wanted to see his passport. Maybe they'd need to be bribed.
But as the men began to fire their guns into the air, panic crept in.
The armed men ran towards the truck, wrenching the door open and pulling Mike from the car, kicking him and beating him over the head with their guns. One hit him in the face, breaking his glasses. He screamed for help and heard his fixer shouting, but without his glasses, he couldn't see. Within seconds, the men had bundled him into a Land Cruiser. The car sped off across the bush.
Mike thought, if this is how the Klan treats their friends, what would happen if he crossed them? This is Hostage, a Parcast original. Every week, we tell the stories behind the most captivating hostage situations and the people inside them.
We'll also cover the psychological tactics used in kidnapping situations and what the human brain does when held captive.
I'm Irma Blanco.
And I'm Carter Roy.
You can listen to all of Parcast's shows on Spotify or anywhere you listen to podcasts. New episodes of Hostage come out every Thursday.
At Parcast, we are grateful for you, our listeners. You allow us to do what we love. Let us know how we are doing. Reach out on Facebook and Instagram at Parcast and Twitter at Parcast Network.
And if you enjoyed today's episode, the best way to help us is to leave a 5-star review wherever you're listening. It really does help. We also now have merchandise. Head to parcast.com/merch for more information.
This is our first episode on the kidnapping of American-German journalist Michael Scott Moore by Somali pirates in 2012.
On January 21st, 2012, Mike was on a reporting trip in the central Somalian region of Galmudug. After dropping his travel companion off at the Galkayo airport, he was pulled from his car and kidnapped. He spent the next 977 days, nearly 3 years, as a hostage of a large organization of Somali pirates, while his mother, the U.S. government, the German government, and a handful of independent contractors worked to secure his release.
This week, we'll look at how Michael Scott Moore ended up in Somalia and delve into the modern piracy in that part of the world in order to understand the kidnapper's motivations. We'll also examine the events surrounding Michael's abduction and his early captivity.
Next week, we'll dig into Mike's experience as a hostage and the physical and psychological struggles he faced in his years of captivity. We'll also track the negotiation work done around the world in an attempt to secure his release from irrational captors with fluctuating demands.
In 1969, the democratically elected president of Somalia, Abdirashad Ali Shamark, was assassinated. Mohamed Siad Barre, a military general, placed the assassinated president's successor under house arrest and declared himself president, announcing that Somalia was now a socialist state.
In reality, Siad Barre implemented an authoritarian government that aligned itself with the communist Soviet Union and Cuba. Somalia is a country made up of clans, and Siad Barre used his newfound power to elevate members of his family, his clan, and the clans he was related to. Suddenly, A country that had never had a serious class issue started to find itself with one as the other clans found themselves stripped of power.
The situation rapidly declined. In the mid-1970s, a drought swept across Somalia, increasing clan pressure on the regime. After a failed attempt to invade Ethiopia and a subsequent break with the Soviets and Cubans, Siad Barre struggled to maintain control, and the regime became increasingly brutal.
Siad Barre was forced out in 1991, but the clan warlords, barely kept in check under the regime, went after each other. Somalia descended into a bloody civil war.
Hoping to get basic supplies to civilians, the United Nations tried to intervene with an international coalition force. But the uneasy peace rapidly disintegrated, and the situation reached its low point when U.S. Special Forces got into a shootout with Somali militia on the streets of the capital, Mogadishu. Hundreds of Somalis and 18 American soldiers died. The catastrophe was dramatized in the movie Black Hawk Down.
Some members of the Sa'ad clan, one of whose warlords had been involved, felt they had unfinished business with the U.S.
After the Battle of Mogadishu, it didn't take long for the U.S. and the U.N. to admit defeat. By 1995, the U.N. peacekeeping mission left Somalia, and the country's civil war raged on.
In the early 2000s, extreme Islamist groups with ties to the likes of Al-Qaeda joined the fray. In 2004, a tsunami decimated the coastline, displacing thousands more people. Several years later, a famine wiped out hundreds of thousands more. Somalia continued to suffer.
In 2004, a transitional government formed in exile in Kenya. When it returned to Somalia in 2006, backed by Ethiopian and UN forces, it found itself faced with a brutal new enemy, an extremist terrorist group called Al-Shabaab. Al-Shabaab attacked and massacred Somali civilians for practicing Sufi Islam, rather than the terrorist group's strict Wahhabist interpretation of Islam.
Against this backdrop of lawlessness and violence, piracy slowly became an issue. From about 2005 on, tankers, fishing boats, freighters, and pretty much any other ship passing through the Gulf of Aden or the western reaches of the Arabian Sea found itself in danger of being attacked by men with AK-47s and rocket-propelled grenades. Their goal was to hold these ships and their cargo for ransom.
Initially, Somali piracy started as a backlash to what local fishermen saw as international poaching. Without a central government to regulate and patrol its shores, Somalia's waters had unofficially become fair game for international fishing companies. European, Chinese, and Middle Eastern fishing firms sent boats to trawl the rich waters off the Horn of Africa and never had to pay any taxes or license fees. As a result, fishing boats were still the most harassed targets, even after pirates started going after bigger, more lucrative ships.
By 2008, piracy, that may have started as desperate action by angry fishermen, had evolved into sophisticated organized crime that merely used fishing rights as an excuse. Once clan lords on land realized there was real money to be made in hijacking ships and holding them for ransom, they set up business enterprises to do just that. In 2009, according to the Kenyan foreign minister, Somali pirates made about $150 million in ransoms.
They sought investors, brought in men to run the operations, and hired local muscle. While the government struggled with Al-Shabaab and overall disarray, the pirate bosses were running organized operations.
The rest of the world quickly realized this was a problem. According to the International Maritime Bureau, 49 of the 53 ships hijacked worldwide in 2010 were hijacked by Somali pirates, with 1,181 people taken hostage. The pirates were costing the global economy up to $12 billion per year.
And that was after 2008, when the UN passed a resolution allowing countries worried about piracy to send warships to the area. Without a Somalian government able to take action against the pirates, the rest of the world wasn't sure what else to do.
2011 was the pirates' last good year. Between the influx of world navies patrolling the waters and merchant ships now traveling with armed guards, the pirates' success rates were declining. In several incidents, pirates had been arrested and shipped abroad for high-profile trials that would see them receive harsh prison sentences.
But the boom years of piracy had been too alluring. Neither the investors nor the underlings were willing to admit that their luck might be running out. Everyone dreamed of getting rich quick. It just required the right ship.
Or the right hostage. By this point, most pirates weren't seafaring men, and they'd turned to kidnapping as another way to extort ransoms from foreigners. They figured the principle was the same as with cargo ships. Somebody would want the hostages back and would be willing to pay for them.
Meanwhile, the war against piracy raged on.
In late 2010, 10 Somali pirates were put on trial in Hamburg, Germany. It was Germany's first piracy trial in approximately 400 years, and the country was riveted.
But no one felt more drawn to the trial than a journalist from Southern California living in Berlin who was looking for his next book subject.
Michael Scott Moore, known to his friends as Mike, grew up in Southern California's suburban San Fernando Valley, the son of an American aerospace engineer and a German secretary who'd met in West Germany in the 1960s.
Bored of California's strip malls and materialism, Mike developed a serious case of wanderlust and set about a career as a freelance journalist. After his first book, a novel called Too Much of Nothing, came out in 2003, he decided to finally put his German passport to use. And in 2005, newly divorced and looking for a fresh start, he moved to Berlin.
Mike used his new base in Europe as a jumping-off point for the rest of the world. An avid surfer, he was shocked to discover just how many places he went had a huge surf culture, Germany included. His next book felt obvious. He'd travel the world to research how the Hawaiian sport had made its way around the globe, discovering distinctive surf cultures and debunking the sport's 1960s California mythology in the process.
In addition to his surfing book, he was interested in other long-form journalism, stories not usually told, about people and places often overlooked. By the time his surfing book, Sweetness in Blood, came out in the summer of 2010, the 41-year-old journalist had traversed the globe, both for the book and for his freelance work. He'd interviewed former political prisoners in Indonesia, surfed in Gaza, ridden a Turkish frigate hunting pirates in the Gulf of Aden, and spent time everywhere from northern Iraq to Cuba.
By the end of 2010, the Somali pirates' trial dominating the news in Germany had caught his interest. In 2009, he'd gone to the East African country of Djibouti to research a series of articles about Somali pirates, and the trial felt like a natural extension of that research.
He asked his editors at Spiegel Online, the digital branch of respected German publication Der Spiegel, to let him cover the trial. As part of his work, he started to dive more deeply into his pirate research. The more he learned, the more intrigued he became. Ideas that had been percolating in Djibouti started to take hold.
He thought of the romanticized ideas of pirates, especially in the Pirates of the Caribbean movies, and started to dig into the history of piracy around the world. In addition to the well-known pirates of the Mediterranean, Atlantic, and Caribbean, it turned out that the Arabian Sea, from the east coast of Africa to the west coast of India, had a long tradition of piracy. As one of history's most well-trodden trade routes, ships passing through had long been susceptible to pirates coming from as far away as North America.
The inquisitive, thoughtful journalist wanted to know more about this latest iteration of pirates. Surely the modern world's answer to the storied Barbary pirates were no more or less brutal than their predecessors. What was driving them? How did they operate? What was the mythology around them in Somalia? Mike saw a chance to do the same thing with pirates that he'd done with surfing. Delve into the past to understand the human truth in its present iteration and dispel long-held romanticized notions about piracy.
As he continued to cover the trial in Hamburg in 2011, Mike started to figure out what it would take to get to Somalia, considered one of the most dangerous places in the world. He was hesitant, not wanting to take any risks, but a friend he'd met on the Djibouti trip, a well-respected Indian documentary filmmaker named Ashwin Raman, was keen to get to Somalia for a project of his own. Ashwin also lived in Berlin, and the two agreed to team up.
During the trial, Mike befriended a German government court interpreter who was able to introduce the two men to a Somali elder who lived in Berlin. The elder, a man named Mohammed Sahal Gerlach, happened to be from the same town as many of the pirates on trial and had a good track record as a fixer, or someone who makes travel and security plans for journalists going to the Galmudug region. He figured he could help Mike and Ashwin in their research, too.
As the trial dragged on, Mike applied for funding from the Pulitzer Center on Crisis Reporting and secured commissions from both the Atlantic and Pacific Standard. When his Pulitzer Center grant came through, the project finally started to come to life. He'd be going places other journalists hadn't braved, doing research no one else had done.
Little did he know, he would have a much more in-depth experience of Somali pirate life than he ever could have imagined.
Next, Mike comes face to face with pirates.
Now back to the story.
In early January 2012, Somali pirates were starting to realize their glory days might be over, and the Somali government was finally starting to wrest control from al-Shabaab and other warring factions. At this moment in history, 42-year-old journalist Michael Scott Moore landed in Somalia.
Along with Indian documentary filmmaker Ashwin Raman, Mike flew from Nairobi, Kenya, to Galkayo in Somalia's Galmudug region. One of the most successful pirate operations was centered in Galkayo, and it was booming thanks to the influx of ransom money. Pirates, like every other group in Somalia, organized within the clan system, and those in Galmudug were part of the Sa'ad clan. And the only way to get to interview them was with connections from and protection by non-pirate Sa'ads.
Gerlach, the fixer from Berlin, was originally from Galkayo, so he made arrangements for the journalists with both his government contacts and extended family members.
The plan was to start in Galkayo. Then they would travel 125 miles to Hobyo, a coastal outpost that could more accurately be considered a pirate boom town. So rapid was its transformation from fishing village to modern town. Some semblance of government existed in Galkayo, but Hobyo was entirely run by pirate bosses.
In Galkayo, the journalists were welcomed by the regional president of Galmudug, though they quickly realized that the president's authority was somewhat ceremonial. With the federal government still fighting for control of the country, regional governments were more about titles, funds, and grappling with pirates for control of the region than actual governing.
Indeed, the president readily admitted he had no control over Hobyo. The pirates ran the show.
The instability was immediately apparent to both Mike and Ashwin, both of whom had spent time in war-torn regions. As a result of the difficult logistics, their trip to Hobyo kept getting delayed, and the two journalists found themselves stuck in limbo in sun-baked Galkayo. Water and electricity flickered on and off, and the energy-sapping heat and humidity made everything feel a bit surreal.
The sense of waiting was nerve-wracking, too. The men started to get antsy. Mike was worried about the reliability of the guards they'd hired. Ashwin was nervous about being stuck in their grimy hotel.
And then, the day before they were finally supposed to leave for Hobyo, Gerlach, the fixer who'd organized their security and travel arrangements, sent an assistant to tell them he'd heard a rumor that a local pirate lord, a man named Mohammed Garfanji, was offering a $15 million reward for Mike's kidnapping. Neither Gerlach nor his assistant thought it was true, but even rumors could be dangerous. The journalist had to decide if they wanted to continue their journey.
Mike and Ashwin conferred. Flights didn't run from Galkayo to Nairobi every day, so they'd be stuck in Galkayo a bit longer anyway. Plus, trying to cancel their Hobyo arrangements could alert any fortune-seeking pirates that they'd heard the rumors and lead to trouble.
Ashwin, who'd spent far more time in dangerous war zones than Mike, pointed out that if this Mohammed Garfanji wanted to kidnap him, his men could have come to the hotel where they were sitting ducks. And anyway, Gerlach had said that if they were kidnapped, it would start a clan war, which no one wanted. Their fixers, most likely, just wanted more money.
The next day, the journalists and their fixers headed out for Hobyo with twice the normal number of guards in a caravan of three Land Rovers and one technical, a cannon-mounted flatbed truck. While the regional president couldn't come with them, they had a Sa'ad clan leader named Digzi, who probably carried more sway with the pirates than any official governmental figure.
Driving across the dusty bush was hard going, so they broke up the trip with a night in a midway village, hosted by relatives of Digzi. The difference from Galkayo was immediately obvious. They were on the edge of the desert, and the people and surroundings reflected that. One of their guards, who'd been with them throughout the trip, was more alert, conscious that pirates operated more freely here.
At dinner, everyone ate spaghetti with their hands out of the same pan. Digzi made a production of giving Mike the best piece of goat meat, singling him out as a guest of honor. Instead of feeling welcome, though, Mike's hackles went up. Something felt off about the overly ceremonial gesture, though he couldn't say what.
The next day, the caravan bounced into Hobyo. The coastal pirate outpost was unimpressive, apart from a few mansions that the fixers said were owned by pirate bosses. One of them had a sculpture of a land cruiser atop its gate, as if proclaiming that successful pirates would be rewarded with land cruisers of their own.
The town's beach was eerily empty, but for a wrecked Chinese fishing boat that had been beached after pirates hijacked it in 2010. The crew had been taken hostage 15 months ago. One of the fixers posited they were probably being held captive in or near the town's mosque. All of them, that is, but the one who had killed himself.
Digzi told them that 1 or 2 years ago, the beach hadn't been this empty. Hijacked ships used to line the waterfront, but now piracy was finally on the decline.
Moments later, the guards yelled and machine gun fire crackled. The journalists and their fixers darted back across the beach to the cars. It seemed that pirates were watching them. It certainly didn't feel like piracy was on the decline.
When they were finally allowed to leave the beach, the caravan went to the house of a man who introduced himself as the mayor of Hobyo, and whom the fixer said was a bandit. The two seemed to go hand in hand here. The mayor begged for international aid to fight the pirates, but Mike and Ashwin tried to explain that they weren't part of the EU or UN, that they were merely journalists.
And then they finally got to meet a pirate, the purpose of their whole trip. A man wearing a keffiyeh over his face arrived and introduced himself as Mustafa Mohammed Sheikh. As the journalists interviewed him, an elder whispered to him, as if telling him what to say. The entire situation was weird. Mike suspected they were being played. He just didn't know how.
The pirates said he was at war with the West, which was stealing their fish and poisoning their water. The rich West was oppressing the poor Somalis. He refused to acknowledge that many of the shipping companies whose ships had been hijacked were from Asian, Middle Eastern, and African companies, and that most of their hostages were from equally or even more impoverished backgrounds. He parroted righteous platitudes about the persecution from the West.
Before they left Hobyo, Ashwin asked the pirate if he had ever kidnapped people on land. The pirate rejected the notion, saying they wouldn't kidnap innocent people. Evidently, they didn't consider the sailors innocent.
The caravan drove up the coast to spend the night, then headed back towards Galkayo in the morning. But before long, Mike realized they weren't heading back to the city. Instead, they were heading up to a town where another German journalist had been several years prior. Dixie wanted them to take the same picture of the coast that the other journalist had to show how many fewer hijacked ships there were these days.
But something rubbed Mike the wrong way about the change of plan without their consultation. He insisted they go straight back to Galkayo and told Gerlach as much. But when Gerlach called Dixie to tell him to keep the original plan, Dixie got angry. Gerlach eventually won out, but Dixie's pride had been wounded.
Back in Galkayo, both Mike and Ashwin agreed they should leave as soon as possible. While Galkayo felt safe compared to their excursion around Galmudug, the disagreement between Gerlach and Dixie had left them uneasy.
Ashwin's plan was to fly to Mogadishu for a few days, while Mike was going straight back to Nairobi before heading home. But Galkayo wasn't a big airport. While Ashwin could leave for Mogadishu the next day, the next flight to Nairobi wouldn't be for a few more days, which wasn't necessarily a problem. Staying a couple extra days would give Mike time to try and interview the families of the pirates on trial in Germany, who lived in a part of Galkayo controlled by a different clan.
Knowing Mike's uneasiness, especially after the rumors about a pirate wanting him kidnapped, Ashwin offered to stick around. But Mike didn't want to make Ashwin stay in Galmudug for no reason, so he and the fixers figured out a plan to get the right security so they could go to the other part of Galkayo. With that in place, Mike felt as confident as possible about staying on his own for a few more days.
The airport road was notoriously dangerous, and kidnappers were known to operate there, so the plan was that the whole crew would escort Ashwin to the airport the next day. There, they would meet a UN contact of one of the fixers, who would have a strong security team with members of the right clan, so they could safely visit the other neighborhood of Galkayo. Everything seemed to be working out nicely.
But the next morning, January 21st, things didn't go according to plan. First, the journalist's regular guard detail, who had been with them throughout this trip, didn't show up. Gerlach called the president, their official host, who sent a car with one gunman to take them to the airport. The journalists didn't like it, but they didn't have much of a choice if Ashwin wanted to make his flight and Mike wanted to get his interviews. And anyway, they knew they were all safest together.
The drive out was uneventful, but as they waited at the airport, the UN contact called and apologized. His security team was urgently needed elsewhere, so they wouldn't be able to meet the group to escort them for the interviews.
Without the UN detail, Mike refused to go to the other part of Galkayo. They didn't have enough security, and it would have been a dangerous trip anyway. But they still had to get back to town, and they still only had one car and one gunman.
Mike's anxiety rose, but there wasn't anything he could do. He had to rely on these men, and he had to rely on Gerlach, who had promised time and again that, should anyone kidnap them, he would be kidnapped too. And if he were kidnapped, it would start a clan war, which nobody wanted. So Mike knew he had to stick with Gerlach and hope that his protection was enough.
While they waited for Ashwin's much-delayed flight, the men chatted. Gerlach's assistant asked for Mike's email address, and Mike handed him his card from Der Spiegel online. The fixer read Mike's full name aloud.
This caught the attention of a man at the next table. He asked, "You are Michael Scott Moore?"
This caught Mike off guard. Why would this man know his name? Perhaps they'd been in Galkayo long enough that word had started to get around.
The man continued, I've seen you on the internet. You are famous.
Mike was confused. No, I'm not, he replied.
But perhaps he was famous in Galmudug now. If rumors had been swirling since their arrival that a pirate boss wanted him kidnapped, his name was out there. He and Ashwin had been meeting with politicians, elders, and even pirates. They were becoming local celebrities.
Mike tried to quiet the anxiety that had been haunting him all morning. There was nothing he could do at this point. He'd been anxious throughout the trip, paranoid about every interaction, and thus far, nothing had happened. Why should things change now?
All the same, he couldn't shake the nagging feeling that something was terribly wrong. Next, we'll find out just how right Mike was.
Now, back to the story.
On the afternoon of January 21st, 2012, 42-year-old journalist Michael Scott Moore bid farewell to his friend and fellow journalist Ashwin Rahman at the Galkayo Airport. Ashwin got on a flight to Mogadishu, Somalia's capital, and the men looked forward to meeting up in Germany once they both got home.
And then Mike and his fixers climbed into the regional president's jeep and headed back to their hotel in Galkayo. They only had one gunman for protection and knew the road was dangerous, but everything in Galmudug was dangerous. They'd been okay thus far.
They hadn't been driving long when the driver took his foot off the gas and spoke cautiously in Somali. Up ahead, off the side of the road, he'd spotted a technical, one of the cannon-mounted flatbed trucks that had been ubiquitous in Somalia since the outbreak of civil war in 1991, more than 20 years earlier.
The mood in the car tensed. The men loitering on the technical didn't seem especially alert or to be paying attention to the cars going by, but any technical could be a threat.
Anxious, Mike asked, "Can we just drive on?"
But Gerlach relaxed and said, "It's one of ours."
Indeed, Mike could see the words Kabir Jabiye painted onto it, a slogan that indicated the technical was owned by members of Gerlach Saad clan. That meant it wasn't hostile.
A car behind them honked. Suddenly, the technical roared to life.
As the truck pulled out in front of them, forcing their car to stop, men armed with AK-47s jumped off the back, running towards them.
In his memoir, The Desert and the Sea, Mike writes that his first reaction was denial. His brain shied away from what he was seeing, from what he knew intellectually was happening. He convinced himself this must be just a traffic stop. The men probably wanted to see his passport, which was right there in his bag. Maybe they would have to be paid off. Even as he saw the technical's cannon point at them and the gun-toting men running towards him, his brain tried to convince him that this was nothing to be afraid of.
According to doctors David A. Alexander and Susan Klein, denial is, in fact, a common and reasonable reaction to extreme stress. It's a survival response that allows, quote, the individual a delayed period during which he or she has the time to adjust to a painful reality. While Mike marveled at his brain's ability to separate him from the obvious reality of the situation, it was, in fact, going into survival mode in order to keep him from panicking and mishandling the situation.
It wasn't until the men swarmed around his door and started firing their guns into the air that it started to sink in that something might truly be wrong. He cowered away from the gunfire, terrified, leaning against Gerlach, as if shrinking toward the other man's body would somehow protect him from the bullets outside.
When the gunfire stopped, he realized they'd try to open the door next and tried to keep it closed, clinging to it with his right hand. He hoped that he could buy time for their sole guard to do his job, but the man didn't fire a shot, clearly aware he was outmatched.
And in any case, Mike was no match for the group of men who managed to wrench the door open. To get him to let go, they pounded the butts of their guns into his wrist, breaking the bones. They pulled him from the car and continued to kick him and beat him over the head with their guns. He screamed for help, but none came, even as he heard Gerlach shouting.
When his glasses fell off and were broken in the scuffle, Mike lost what ability he had to discern what was happening around him. Unable to tell people apart or see very far, he could only focus on his own survival. His wrist hurt, and he could tell he was bleeding. The men yanked his backpack away from him and hustled him toward a waiting SUV.
He was shoved into the back of the car, squished between three gunmen. They raced into Galkayo, where he saw the kidnappers drop his backpack off with the tall man in a driveway. And then the car raced back out of town and across the bush, bouncing over the dirt as they headed, he presumed, east towards the coast.
The men, now calm after the initial furor of the attack, tried to reassure Mike by saying things like, okay, and no problem, as if anything they said could put him at ease.
Now that the initial adrenaline rush had passed, every bump made Mike's broken wrist scream. When a bump slammed his head into the car ceiling, he swore in pain and pointed to the bloodstain he'd left there. The pirates didn't seem concerned.
After several hours, they arrived at a camp in the bush, where other pirates and hostages were waiting. A young pirate who wasn't one of the kidnappers led Mike to a foam mattress in the shade of a cliff and incongruously asked if he was okay. For whatever reason, Mike focused his anger on his missing backpack with its camera in it.
The young pirate asked, "They steal your camera? Thieves."
He seemed sincere. Mike was confused. It was his first brush with the incoherence of piracy.
That night, he didn't think he'd be able to sleep. His mind raced, jumping from his friends and family in California and Berlin to how this could possibly have happened. His kidnapping would turn his mother's life upside down and cause her so much pain and anguish. It would do the same for his friends in Berlin. He didn't want to do that to them. Had he really been so careless as to let this happen to himself without thought of consequences for the people he loved?
And he wondered if Gerlach was free and alive, and if he'd had a chance to call Ashwin. If Gerlach weren't free, perhaps a clan war was about to break out. If not, then someone in the Sa'ad clan had sold them out. Who? How? It was impossible to know where exactly he'd gone wrong.
The next morning, Mike was pushed into a car and tied together with two middle-aged hostages, who he would later learn were fishermen from the Seychelles. They bounced along the coastal thoroughfare known as the Pirate Road until they encountered another car. The cars stopped, and the hostages were hustled into the new car, their captors hitting them for not moving fast enough.
Once they were in the new car, one of the pirates, who seemed to have some authority, leaned in the window to speak to Mike. He said, quote, "We know about your activities as a journalist, but it is okay. If you can pay the ransom, you will go free."
And then the cars sped off. Mike wasn't sure what the pirate meant. Did they not like him asking questions about them? Or did they think he was somehow affiliated with the UN or the EU? And he didn't even know where to start with the idea of a ransom. As a freelance journalist, he didn't make a lot of money. He didn't even have kidnapping insurance. His application had been turned down since he'd been traveling as a freelancer. And his retired mother and stepfather certainly didn't have much extra money.
Their destination that night was a house in a coastal town. Mike suspected it might be either Hobyo or a nearby village. He was shuffled into his own room and presented with a pot of beans to eat, but as soon as he tried, he vomited them back up. This upset his captors, who insisted he needed to eat to stay alive. It provided some small relief. They wanted him alive.
A new man with an air of confidence came in to chastise him in English. He said, quote, "You have made a mistake. Mistakes are human." It was a refrain that would come to haunt Mike. He had clearly made some mistakes, but he wasn't sure what they were.
They stayed in the house for a couple days and started to find some kind of a routine. The pirates brought Mike clean clothes, though they were admittedly too small for the tall journalist. They brought him other food, including a box of oatmeal that a pirate promptly stole from him. He learned to shower and use the bathroom at gunpoint. A doctor of sorts was brought in to set his wrist in a splint.
His mind raced between petty injustices, such as the pirate that had stolen his oatmeal, and the chaos of the abduction, bouncing between his immediate problems and a situation he couldn't begin to comprehend.
And then, a few days later, a car arrived in the middle of the night. Mike was wakened and hustled out the door and into the waiting Land Cruiser. One of the middle-aged Seychellois hostages was shoved in with him. The pirates seemed panicked, a terrifying proposition when they all carried Kalashnikovs.
As they drove, the pirate, who seemed to be in charge of their car, a man Mike had learned was called Ahmed Diri, shouted at Mike, demanding to know if he was in the U.S. military. The journalist was confused. Of course not. But as the men gestured and shouted angrily in Somali, he picked up a few words: helicopters and American.
American military had just carried out an operation in Somalia. And according to Mike's captors, about a dozen Somalis had died. No wonder they were upset and scared.
Mike wasn't sure what to believe. Since the Battle of Mogadishu, the U.S. kept its military out of Somalia as much as possible, and he knew that pirates were prone to rumors. It seemed most likely that they were freaking out about nothing. But if there was even a chance that the U.S. military had operated in Somalia, maybe they would come for him. Assuming anyone even knew he'd been kidnapped, the possibility planted the seed of hope.
What Mike didn't know was that the previous day, January 25th, 2012, the fourth day of his kidnapping, the U.S. had, in fact, sent a team of Navy SEALs to rescue two aid workers who'd been kidnapped by other pirates in the Galmudug region. One of the aid workers, Jessica Buchanan, was American and was suffering from serious medical problems. The military had determined she needed to be rescued immediately, and they figured out a way to get both her and her Danish colleague out of the camp that was holding them.
While the mission had been a success, nine Somali pirates had died in the raid, and now every other pirate in the area was panicked. They already assumed that the U.S. military was tracking them with drones, but lethal raids to extract hostages was a terrifying new escalation.
From the pirates' perspective, hostages were their livelihood. And so they were going to do everything it took to keep their hostages from being rescued.
But it also meant, in their minds, that the U.S. now owed them for having murdered nine of their clansmen. And Mike was a living manifestation of the United States, a member of the American clan held entirely at their mercy.
Next week on Hostage, we'll follow Mike's 3 years of captivity, from the Somali bush to a hijacked commercial fishing boat, and delve into the psychological tactics he used to keep himself from giving up. We'll also look at the years-long negotiation between his mother and the pirates in an effort to get him released. Thanks again for tuning in to Hostage. We'll be back next Thursday with a new episode.
You can find more episodes of Hostage, as well as all of Parcast's other shows, on Spotify or anywhere else you listen to podcasts.
Several of you have asked how to help us. If you enjoy the show, the best way to help is to leave a 5-star review.
And don't forget to follow us on Facebook and Instagram at Parcast and Twitter at Parcast Network. We'll see you next time.
In the meantime, don't take your freedom for granted.
Hostage was created by Max Cutler, is a production of Cutler Media, and is part of the Parcast Network. It is produced by Max and Ron Cutler, sound design by Dick Schroeder, with production assistance by Ron Shapiro and Paul Mahler. Additional production assistance by Maggie Admire and Freddie Beckley. Hostage is written by Kate Thorman and stars Irma Blanco and Carter Roy.